Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WJUP 103.9 FM, Sunday morning, January 10th, 2016. It's the new year. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. My guest is author and Pulitzer Prize and Emmy-winning journalist Hedrick Smith, author of Who Stole the American Dream, and today's discussion is a revisit to our 2012 show, how this came about, and what possibly we can do about it in the future. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. To that end, most of my shows are devoted to that purpose. Welcome, Hedrick Smith, to the Advocates.
Great to be with you, Richard, once again.
Thank you. Hedrick Smith, a Pulitzer Prize-winning former New York Times reporter and editor and Emmy-winning award producer, correspondent, has covered Washington world capitals for the New York Times, authored many bestselling books, of course, created 20 award-winning PBS primetime specials and mini-series. For 26 years, Mr. Smith served as correspondent for the New York Times in Washington, Moscow, Cairo, Saigon, Paris, and the American South. In 1971, as chief diplomatic correspondent, he was a member of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team that produced the Pentagon Papers series. In 1974, he won the Pulitzer Prize for international reporting from Russia and Eastern Europe. And from the late 70s through the 80s, he was the New York Times Washington Bureau Chief and Chief Correspondent. He began creating series, documentary series on PBS in 1989 with his adaptation of his best-selling book, The Power Game. And PBS viewers saw Mr. Smith for 25 years as a principal panelist on Washington Week in Review and has seen him as a special correspondent on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. You know, 3 years ago, you joined me on The Advocates to discuss your book, Who Stole the American Dream? On the first page of your book, you quote Aristotle on politics. He stated, "Thus, it is manifest that the best political community is formed by citizens of the middle class, and that those states are likely to be well administered in which the middle class is large and stronger, if possible, than both classes." On national public radio, you stated that our greatest period of growth, especially for the middle class, came between 1943 and 73. Hedrick, what changed that positive economic dynamic that emerged from the New Deal, the winning of the war, the GI Bill? What was that?
Well, Richard, to me, writing the book and I guess always, two things have been important, ideas and power. And the two things that changed after the mid-70s were ideas and power. Prior to that period, in terms of power, there was a great exercise of power along the lines that Aristotle suggested, by the middle class. There were middle class movements to try to influence public policy, the women's movement, the environmental movement, the consumer movement, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, and the anti-war movement during the Vietnam period. These were periods where people literally demonstrated, marched, met with members of Congress, pushed on the government, and pushed on the government, by the way, to level or try to level somewhat the American economic playing field. High taxes on the people at the top, cut off the tops of the mountains under Dwight Eisenhower, 92% income tax under John F. Kennedy, 77% income tax. Republicans and Democrats alike, very high taxes. And a pretty persistent raising of the minimum wage for the people at the bottom throughout that period with strong bipartisan votes, influenced very much by public pressure. So power was being exercised and demonstrated by the middle class. That had a big effect on public policy. And then in terms of economics, you had business leaders who believed that sharing the wealth with the middle class, not concentrating it at the top, was smart business and good economics. Guys like Charlie Wilson, who ran General Motors, or Reg Jones, who ran General Electric, or others who ran Coca-Cola, DuPont, you name them, IBM, Tom Watson, people like that, they believed it was the job of the CEO to balance, as they put it, to balance the economic interests of the stakeholders. That's the term they used, the stakeholders in the company. And that didn't just mean the shareholders. That meant the employees, the managers, the suppliers, the communities they operated in, the banks that gave them credit, the customers that wanted their products served over their lifetime of their products, whether a refrigerator or an automobile or today it would be a cell phone or whatever. So you had a different philosophy at work. The idea was, and this is part of what generated this enormous wealth, growth, prosperity, shared prosperity in America over that long period, 30 years plus after the end of World War II. What changed was two things. Number one, we moved slowly into an era where corporate leaders believed in what they call shareholder capitalism, but which should really be called managerial capitalism. That is, the job of the CEO is not to balance the interests of the stakeholders, not to take care of everybody, but first and foremost to deliver, as Milton Friedman, the great Chicago University economist, put it, to deliver maximum return to shareholders. Highest profit, boost the share price, and that often meant cutting jobs, cutting workers, shipping work overseas. Really, it worked to the disadvantage of the middle class, and it's led, that philosophy has led, particularly carried into public policy, has led to the enormous inequalities of income that we see in America today, far greater than we've had perhaps at any time in our history, except maybe at the end of the booming 1920s. That was one thing that happened. The idea changed. The other thing that happened was power change. There was a reaction. I mean, it's almost Newtonian. It's almost like Newton's law of physics. For every action, there's an equal and positive reaction. Well, in politics, maybe the same thing happened. That strong set of middle-class movements that I mentioned to you, women's movement, environmental movement, labor movement, civil rights movement, and so forth, all those movements caused a reaction by the corporate elite. A guy named Lewis Powell, a very famous corporate attorney who had good friends at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and was later put on the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon in 1972, the Republican president back then. Powell was upset at what he saw, the power of the labor unions and all these movements. They thought they were biting into the profits. They were limiting. He even said at one point, American capitalism is in jeopardy. I don't think many other people would have said capitalism was in jeopardy, but there certainly was a far wider sharing of wealth, and that meant that the people at the top, although they made a lot more than the people at the bottom, 30, 40 times as much as the average worker is what the CEO made back in those days, they felt pinched. Powell said, you got to get organized. He wrote a manifesto. He wrote a memo that was circulated privately by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to CEOs and corporate leaders all over the country. And he said, basically, you got to take a leaf from the book of organized labor. You got to get involved politically. You got to move to Washington. You got to go for the high ground, put money into political campaigns, spend money on lobbying. Up until that point, there really had only been about 175 companies that even had offices in Washington. It's amazing to look back at that era of the 1960s and 70s and see how little business was doing to try to influence government policy in a direct way compared to what's going on today. Powell said, you got to get into the game, you got to fight these people, and he names them. In fact, his manifesto is a memo. Is such an important document that I got Random House to put it in the appendix of my book, Who Stole the American Dream, so people could read it for themselves. But it's an amazing document. I mean, he treats these domestic movements, he treats Walter Reuther, the head of the United Auto Workers Union, as almost a bigger threat to American capitalism than Soviet communism, which at that time in the middle of the Cold War was a pretty significant military threat as far as everybody else was concerned. Anyway, Powell's memo fell on very fruitful ground. Within a year or two, companies began to move offices to Washington. The Chamber of Commerce itself doubled its staff, tripled its budget. By 1980, before Reagan was elected, by the way, by 1980, there were now 2,400 companies with offices in Washington. It went from 175 to 2,400. There were 50,000 people by 1980 in Washington working for business trade associations. There were 9,000 registered corporate lobbyists. There were 8,000 corporate PR people in Washington. There was an army. I call it Powell's army. And they began to put the heat on the government to change policies. And that began to happen. And believe it or not, it was a surprise to me. It actually began under Jimmy Carter. with the Democrats in charge of Congress, even before Reagan was elected. Reagan accelerated the trend, but it was under Carter that you got a change in the the capital gains tax laws. You got a reduction in the corporate tax itself. You got the deregulation. You got the passage of the 401k plan that began to replace lifetime pensions for workers and companies with more than 100 employees. That was the dominant thing during the 60s and the 70s. By 1980, 84% of the people who worked for big companies had lifetime pensions. Today, that number is down about 20%, and that change began with a law that was written for the 401k plan under Jimmy Carter in 1978.
Yeah.
So this is what happened from that lobbying army.
Right. You know, Hedrick,
that Powell got set up. So the power changed, and policy began to change with it.
Yeah. Hedrick, you know, bring us up to date a sense. 2 weeks ago in the New York Times, a story was printed how the wealthiest families have built a private tax system for the rich. And I quote, "With inequality at its highest levels in nearly a century, and public debate rising over whether the government should respond to it through higher taxes on the wealthy, the very richest Americans have financed a sophisticated and astonishingly effective apparatus for shielding their fortunes. And this operates, obviously, out of the public view. Has this exacerbated and made it worse from what you talked about from the dominance of capital over labor?"
Yeah, there's no question that that's happened. There's no question that it's happened. What this story assumes you know is that the tax cuts under Reagan delivered $1 trillion of additional wealth to the top 1 or 2% in America each decade since then. A trillion in the 80s, a trillion in the 90s, a trillion in the 2000s, and the tax cuts of George Bush delivered another $1 trillion in the 2000s. From 1979 to 2011 or 12, 84% of the growth in the entire nation's income went to the top 1%. That means they got five times as much money, in part through tax evasion, in part through tax policies, and in part through the way private sector business operated. They got five times as much money as the rest of the 99% of the public. So you've got not only these tax schemes operating, which the New York Times has exposed, but that's on top of this enormous concentration of wealth to begin with. So when people are talking about, you know, we ought to raise the tax rates on the wealthy, maybe just start, as the New York Times is suggesting, with closing the loophole.
Yeah.
And
well,
the other thing the Times has reported is that 158 families, 158, that's a tiny number of people, have contributed half of all the political money for the political campaign in the 2015-26 campaign so far.
Yeah,
so
well,
not that money is flowing into our political system and affecting our politics.
Well, let's get into that in a sense, and also remember that six Walmart heirs who have $140 billion own more of America than the bottom 40%. You know, getting more up to date, recently you wrote in your piece, "The Price We Pay for Corporate Money in Campaigns, the Case of How Corporate Inversions have Grown." What do you mean by that claim, Hedrick?
Well, what's going on is, and Pfizer was the latest example, what's going on is that American companies have discovered that they can avoid paying American taxes by merging with companies overseas. What Pfizer did was it merged with Allergan, which is it used to be an American company, by the way, and it moved to Ireland, and its headquarters are now in Dublin. And Pfizer merged with, technically let itself be bought out by Allergan, which is a joke because Allergan is nowhere near as large as Pfizer. So it's just that's just a paper game. And by doing that, they then become subject to the Irish income taxes, which are 6.5%, as opposed to the American corporate tax, which is 35%. Now, most of the major American companies don't pay anything like the corporate rate of 35%. They've got all kinds of tax write-offs and loopholes to the point where, Payne Weber, Goldman Sachs, General Electric, and so forth, 80 of them have paid virtually no taxes at all over the last several years. So there are all kinds of gimmicks and loopholes in the tax law, which have been written into the tax law in the same way the New York Times was talking about the breaks they get on the tax system. They've been written into the tax law for corporations so that corporations won't have to pay taxes. What's happened is that the share of revenue that flows to the federal government to pay for defense, the FBI, national parks, you name it, anything in the federal government except for Social Security and Medicare, the corporate share of that has gone from 30% of the total revenues back in the 1950s and 60s down to 10% today. And what that means is individuals are paying more of the share of the income tax. As the corporations become more and more clever at reducing their share of taxes, the burden falls on us, which is one reason why the middle class is hurting. They're hurting because the wages haven't gone up. They're hurting because the jobs aren't as good as they used to be. But they're also hurting because they've got more of the tax burden. So that's what I was talking about.
You know, it's very interesting you bring that up. And it's an interesting situation that... and we're going to get into our next segment in a second, regarding who pays what. You know, it's interesting when you you go from an average of 10 to 12 to 13 billionaires from the middle post-war era up until the 60s and 70s, and then after the Reagan tax cut, which rivaled the Harding, you know, the lowest tax rate on the top bracket, 28%, all of a sudden, within 4 years, you have 49 billionaires. 8 years, you have 99 billionaires. You now have 460 billionaires. You know, we're people who bring this up are always accused of class warfare. But the bottom line is the money goes somewhere.
And well, Warren Buffett has dealt with a class warfare subject. You know, the Sage of Omaha is one of the wealthiest men in America. He says, yeah, sure, there's class warfare going on. It's my class, the wealthy, the super rich, that have been waging it, and we're winning. And I think the economic evidence is behind him. It has been class warfare. Let me go back. Remember, and if you listen to a guy like Charlie Wilson, who ran General Motors, it was the highest paid corporate executive in America, probably in the world, back in the 1950s and 60s. He made $600,000 a year, translated to modern pay. Adjusted for inflation, that'd be about $5 million a year here. An American CEO today just regards himself as grossly underpaid if he makes $5 million.
That's for sure.
He's got to be making much more than that. There has been an enormous inflation of wealth at the top, while pay at the middle has pretty well frozen. That is class warfare economically. It's just not carried out with guns, and it's done in a way that most people don't see it and don't realize it's happening. But that's what's been going on, and Buffett put his finger on it.
No question about that. We have to go to a short commercial break. You're listening to The Advocates, WJUP-FM 103.9. It's Sunday morning, January 10th, 2016. I'm with my guest, Pulitzer Prize and Emmy Award-winning journalist Hedrick Smith. Our subject is Who Stole the American Dream? Revisited, and we're going to try to find some solutions to that. What can be done about this? And we'll be back in a moment or so. Welcome back. This is Sunday morning, January 10th, 2016, to The Advocates on WJUP 103.9 FM with my guest, Mr. Hedrick Smith. Our subject is Who Stole the American Dream? Revisited, how we can deal with what's happening in the future. Hedrick Smith is certainly reviewing the past. We have been talking about how the American economy shifted from a strong labor position in the post-war era, where productivity soared along with wages, to a business era where corporate compensation dwarfed the real wages of their employees. From 1970 through 2000, Fortune 500 employees' compensation barely moved up in real dollars, maybe by 10%. Conversely, the CEOs of these same companies who had earned a ratio of close to 35 to 1 over their employees saw their tax brackets cut by 70% to a 75-year low of 28% under Ronald Reagan, and their salaries soared to 1,000 to 1 or a raise of 3,500%. Hedrick, did the decline of organized labor, the exporting jobs of overseas, the shifting of wealth to the 1%, violate Aristotle's idea of the importance of the middle class to the strength of the best political community?
Well, I think if you look at America, the landscape of American economics and politics today, I think you'd find enormous grievance, and you see it acted out in the people flocking to events by Bernie Sanders on the Democratic left and Donald Trump on the Republican right. There's an upsurge of populism which says, hey, we're getting left out. And that is in violation of what Aristotle was saying. Aristotle was suggesting and stating directly that you get a more enduring, more stable, more effective society and government if the middle class is well represented economically and well represented politically. And what we've seen, and we've been talking about the numbers, what we've seen is what you just described a moment ago, the pay of the median worker, hourly pay and benefits of the median worker, the people right at the beltline, right at the middle of American society, from the mid-70s until the current decade, has gone up about 10% adjusted for inflation. And at the same time, the pay of the CEOs has gone up 400%, and the pay of the people at the top 1% has gone up 600%. So yes, it's what we've done economically has violated what Aristotle was suggesting is a wise thing for a society to do over the long run. And secondly, you've seen that concentration of wealth come through in a concentration of political power. It's a very interesting study that's been done by a couple of Princeton economists, one of them by the name of Martin Gillens. What they did is they wanted to figure out who Congress listens to. Does in fact money buy something, even if people can't say, well, I bought your vote on this bill by giving you a $10,000 campaign contribution? Does the general wealth and affluence of the elite affect the outcomes in Congress? And a lot of people suspect that's true. What Gillens and his partner found was that, in fact, it was true. They went through 10 or 11 years of votes in the U.S. Senate, and they found opinion polls that showed what the elite position was, the top 1 or 2% on those issues, and what the position of the average person was on those issues. And then they checked the votes in Congress, and they found that the Senate, in fact, followed the wishes of the elite. And if the wishes of the elite and the opinions and the policy desires of the elite matched those of the majority, then the majority got what it wanted. But if it didn't, the majority was not paid any attention to at all. I mean, what they concluded at the end was that they could find no issue, and they covered something like 2,200 different votes on issues in Congress. They found no issue on which the majority opinion disagreed with the elite, and the Congress and the Senate went with the majority against the elite. They found many issues which went the other way. So what you found is that, once again, in the political arena, as in the economic arena, the middle class is being ignored. And that's what you're finding in this political campaign. People don't know what to do. We have a system which says you can vote for people. And what I think we need to do is we need to vote for change in the system. We need to get money in politics more under control. We need to fix gerrymandering, which greatly advantages small numbers, favors the elite, multiplies the impact of political money in campaigns. People aren't focused on the system. The media is not focused on the flaws in the system. And yet the public, if you ask them, and there have been lots of opinion polls that have asked them, the public will come back to you and they will say the political system is broken. Confidence in the American political system today is at one of its lowest points in the last four decades. I saw one poll in which people said 60% of the people said America is in decline. Another poll, 63%. Now, that's a huge judgment. This is not saying we're unhappy with Obama, we're unhappy with Trump, we're unhappy with the Republicans, we're unhappy with the media, we're unhappy with the lawyers and the church and so forth, because all those institutions, the media included, get very, very low ratings. Our civilization is in trouble.
Yeah, that's true. Of course, a lot of that is fed, as you said to me earlier, about the media reflecting on the negativity. You know, in 2014, going back to an earlier point, you stated that the shifting of revenues was so pervasive that nearly 75% of the Fortune 500 companies have booked their profits to overseas tax havens. How much does this entail, and where are these tax havens located that people should know?
Well, I think, you know, 75% of the companies in the Fortune 500 are holding profits overseas. They're not necessarily moving profits that they actually picked up in America overseas. These are profits they earned overseas.
Okay.
Well, you're talking about Bermuda. You're talking about the Cayman Islands. You're talking about the Isle of Wight. But you're also talking, believe it or not, you're talking about Ireland, Luxembourg, Belgium, Liechtenstein, Monaco. There are a lot of places where the corporate tax rates are very, very low compared to ours. And in some instances, for example, the people at Apple have gotten so clever that even when they sit in Ireland and they're subject to a 7.5% tax rate as opposed to our 35%, they move the money around so that even the Irish authorities never catch up to it. When they want to tax it in Ireland, they say, no, the money's over there in Luxembourg. And then when Luxembourg wants to get it, they move it back to Ireland. And all of this is done legally, and it's made possible, by the internet, by electronic banking, where money, where trillions can be moved, you know, with a click of an iPad or a click of a mouse. And the figures are staggering. I mean, there's well over $2 trillion in American corporate profits sitting overseas. And if it were brought back to America, it's only taxed if it's brought back to America. If it were brought back to America, it would generate $600 billion in taxes. That'd go a long way to help the deficit. So
yeah, that's a lot of money.
Companies don't want to do that. It's a huge amount of money.
You know, in Everett Dirksen's words, that's a lot of money. You know, getting back to the new economy in the 90s, you mentioned Warren Buffett, one of the richest men in the world, and you mentioned there's class warfare, all right, but it's my class, the rich class is making the war, and we're winning. He hit the nail on the head. You use the term, we have a minute or so left in this segment, you use the term wedge economics. What do you mean by wedge economics?
It's what we've been talking about, Richard. I've been talking, the people at the top are doing extremely well, and the people in the middle are not. It's the wedge driven between the growth of the American economy and the profits of the American corporations and the living standards of the middle class. It used to be that as the economy grew and the corporations profited, the living standard of middle-class Americans rose right along with them. Then in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a wedge driven in the middle, and the people at the top and the corporations and the economy kept growing, and it looked good, but the people in the middle were stuck. There was a wedge that separated them from the growth that was being generated by their work and, you know, by the American companies and the American economy. That's the wedge.
Well, it's interesting that this continues to go on. We've had a recovery that many, many people complain about, obviously, and I think you, as a pretty strong observer of the 20th century, I consider myself one too, we seem to forget that every recovery since the Second World War was built on housing, and of course, this latest mega crash, the Great Recession of 2008 and 9, was really caused by housing, and in a sense, I'm not so sure that we can, in this fast-moving economy, use a model of the past so easily. How do you see this recovery in the context of post-war recoveries?
Well, you got to divide recoveries in the American economy pre-1990 and post-1990. Because prior to 1990, it used to take us about 21 months to go from the bottom of the recession back up to the same level of employment, the rate of unemployment that we had when we went into the recession. In 1991, it jumped up to 26 months. In 2001, 2002, it was 46 months. And then in this last recession, it's been well up over 66 months. So each recession is taking longer. And the reason is fairly simple. It's structural. believe it or not, the job creators in the American economy are the middle class.
Right.
They're the ones who spend the money that drives companies to expand production, hire more workers, buy more equipment, get more efficient, and grow. And if you break this circle, which the economists call the virtuous circle of growth, which we had going in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, if you pay tens of billions of middle-class Americans well, they don't save much money except to go buy their houses and maybe a little bit for retirement or a little bit for their kids' education. But most families don't save very much. They spend their money. That's what drives growth. Now, as American business kept cutting down on jobs and moving people out of good industrial jobs that paid 20 or 22 bucks an hour into being greeters at Walmart that pays $9 an hour, that middle class was not making the same amount of money, so you didn't have the engine driving the economy. That's what causes the slower growth. Mm-hmm. Economists have established this very clearly. Joe Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist at Columbia University, Paul Krugman at Princeton,
sure.
You know, a bunch of other people as well, have done studies which show that when there's high inequality of income, you get slow growth. So whether it's housing that powers it, whether it's the Internet revolution that powers it, whether it's a World War II that powers it, whatever powers the growth, if the pay gets passed through to the middle class and they go spend their money, it generates a continuing flow of growth. Business cycles. But right. That's what we've lost.
Yeah, we have to go to a commercial break. You are listening to The Advocates on WJUP-FM 103.9, Sunday morning, January 10th, 2016. I'm with my guest, Pulitzer Prize winner, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Mr. Hedrick Smith. Our subject is Who Stole the American Dream? Revisited. Hedrick Smith is giving us some background on it, and he's going to try to hopefully give us some solutions in a few minutes. We'll be back in a minute or so. Welcome back. This is Sunday morning, January 10th, 2016, to The Advocates on WJUP 103.9 FM with my guest, Mr. Hedrick Smith, and our subject is Who Stole the American Dream? Revisited. Hedrick, getting back to how big business has blocked corporate tax reform, you have mentioned former Republican Congressman Dave Camp and his efforts as the chairperson of the House Ways and Means Committee. What happened to Mr. Camp's efforts?
Well, Dave Camp is a very interesting guy. He's a conservative Michigan Republican who worked his way up through the ranks in the House and eventually became chairman of this very powerful committee, House Ways and Means Committee, the committee that writes tax legislation. And he was very friendly to business, and he'd been listening to business leaders complain that the American corporate tax rate was too high, and that it was much higher than those in the rest of the world. It's 35%. And in Switzerland, it's 22%. In other countries, it's lower. In Ireland, it's down to 7%, 7.5%. And said, you know, we've got to drop the tax rate. Otherwise, you know, more and more American businesses are going to bail out of America. So he was very sympathetic to that idea. If you cut the tax rate, say, from 35% to 25% in one fell swoop, you lose a lot of revenue. And so Camp reasonably said, we got to make up that revenue somehow. And there are $1.2 trillion a year. That's a huge number, $1.2 trillion a year in corporate tax loopholes. So almost nobody's paying that 35% tax rate because they get loopholes for, you know, depletion allowances in the oil industry and research and development and all kinds of loopholes. And particularly if you make money overseas, you don't bring your profits home, you don't pay any taxes. So what Camp said was, we got to close some of these loopholes to make up for lost revenue. And business people were really enthusiastic about Camp's plan. But when he brought it out and he showed them that he was going to close their loopholes, they immediately turned on him. Camp was actually going out to Park City, Utah. I think he was going out to some fundraiser that a bunch of corporations were going to hold for him in his honor. And he expected to be greeted with cheers and everything. I mean, they gave him the Bronx cheer. They booed him. And they immediately attacked him. And within about two or three days, they got 50 Republican members of the House to come out against Camp's tax proposal, even though he was doing one of the big steps that business said it wanted, and it was dead before it ever got off the ground. And the reason was business did not want its tax loopholes closed, and business had so much clout with members of Congress, they killed the policy without a vote.
Yeah.
There wasn't even a committee hearing. There wasn't even the first thing that was done. It died in the crib. It was strangled in the crib.
Yeah, I know Park City. I hope he enjoyed the visit there. It's a nice town. Aside from the brickbats he got thrown instead of the bouquets, it's a heck of a nice town. Obviously, there's a lot of money in play regarding the lobby from corporate America brought up by the emergence of Justice Lewis Powell as a big operating lawyer. You spent a lot of time on Powell in your book, and you spent a lot of time with him here. How much does this entail, and where does it flow from, and how does the Citizens United ruling facilitate this influence?
Well, it's a series of court decisions by the current Supreme Court that go back to the 1970s. And even to the 1880s. In the 1880s, there was a Supreme Court ruling that said corporations are people.
Mm.
And that's very important because the people, by the Bill of Rights, are allowed to do all kinds of things, associate and have free speech. And then in Citizens United, you get a decision in which, and by the way, it's very interesting, there was a law passed. I went back and did the history on this. It was a law passed in 1907. Under Teddy Roosevelt, which barred corporations from putting any money into political campaigns.
Hmm.
So if you come forward to Citizens United in 2010, that's a century. For a century, we had a law that said corporations could not spend their own money on political campaigns. Now, they could have political action committees or the CEO or individual members of the company. They could put money in, but the corporation could not tap its enormous treasury to go into political campaigns. Citizens United changed that. Citizens United said corporations and unions and other institutions can do that. And people will say, well, it's a level playing field. Corporations can do it, then unions can do it. There's an enormous difference in the amount of economic power in corporations and in trade unions. Businesses outspend trade unions in political campaigns, at least the most recent campaigns, not the current one. We don't know what the numbers are in the current one, but 16 to 1. And in terms of lobbying, they outspend trade unions, business outspends trade unions in lobbying in Washington, 60 to 1.
Hmm.
And in terms of soft money and the money that's hard to track, businesses outspend trade unions 90 to 1. So it's not a level playing field. I mean, Citizens United has opened the floodgates. It's not... And not just my phrase, but the phrase of one of the Supreme Court justices himself. It's just created an explosion of political money. Our campaigns were expensive, but now they're tremendously expensive. I mean, here you have Jeb Bush having raised over $100 million for the preliminary of his campaign, for the primaries of his campaign. Ted Cruz is up $40 million plus. Hillary Clinton's up around $50 million. Just enormous amounts of money. And this is for super PACs, and the super PACs are technically not run by the candidate. In fact, they're often run by the candidate's former campaign manager. The candidate even goes, I mean, the Supreme Court is like it's blind, not paying any attention, saying there's no connection between super PACs and the candidates. There is. There's every bit of connection. It's just the orders don't go directly from the candidate to the super PAC on what to do, but the super PAC knows what to do. We are now flooded with money. Last presidential election year, 2012, about $7 billion was spent on politics. And this one, it'll be over $10 billion easily. And what's more important in some ways is not just the total amount of money, but the dark money. The dark money is money that you can't track. Businesses, American Express, Apple, Boeing, General Motors, General Foods, particularly companies that have consumer products, they don't want their customers to know what political candidates they're backing. People might get offended and say, I'm not going to Starbucks anymore if I know they're supporting X as a candidate in my state. So companies want to make their corporation contributions secret, and they can do that now. Dark money is exploding. Back in 2006, 10 years ago, there was only $5 million in dark money in the campaigns. In 2012, it was $300 million. This year, it's going to be well over $500 million and perhaps pushing $1 billion. That's money we can't track. We can't say candidate X is being backed by this company, the oil company, or a pharmaceutical company, or a defense company, defense manufacturer. Very important, because voters can often judge who the candidate is backed by and then figure out, well, that's the kind of policy this candidate is going to vote for, and I'm not going to vote for him. And if you actually see that played out in specific elections, if that information's out there, it becomes very important to voters.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that Jeb Bush, I think, has spent, I don't know, $40 million alone. He may break John Connolly's record, you know, of spending for one delegate. I think John Connolly spent probably in today's money probably pretty close to that regarding inflation. We have to go to a short commercial break. You're listening to The Advocates, WJUP FM 103.9. Sunday morning, January 10th, 2016, I'm with my guest, Pulitzer Prize winner and Emmy Award winning journalist, Mr. Hedrick Smith. Our subject has been the American economy, where it's going, reflective of our interview of a few years ago, who stole the American dream. We'll be back in a moment or so with our concluding segment. Welcome back. This is Sunday morning, January 10th, 2016, to The Advocates on WJUP 103.9 FM. My guest is Mr. Hedrick Smith. Our subject is the American economy, reflective of his very interesting and worthwhile book, Who Stole the American Dream, where he chronicles what happened in the last decades after the Second World War, how it came about. You know, in this last segment, Hedrick, let's talk about solutions and actual actions being taken at the state level with regards to efforts to expose large previously secret donors to campaigns, public financing of elections, the increase in the minimum wage, states ending gerrymandering, and efforts to amend the Constitution. First of all, can you tell our audience about California and the dark money scheme of GOP campaign strategist Anthony Russo and Jeff Miller? Give us a little background on that.
Well, I can. Dark money, we were just talking about, is critical. And the Koch brothers from Kansas, the energy billionaires, have moved money around and are moving money around into all kinds of campaigns. And they were doing that in a campaign in California. And they were trying to do it without being spotted. Actually, some people in California raised money, passed it to these guys you were talking about. These are political operatives in California, Miller and Russo. Got it out of the state and brought it back into the state because they didn't want to have it tracked. And they began to run ads on a couple of popular referendums to try to swing the popular vote. And what happened was they got exposed. The state of California found them, discovered that this was going on, exposed it, exposed the Koch network, got these guys to agree that they'd violated the state law in terms of trying to hide the sources of the money that was involved. And they actually passed what is now the best, toughest disclosure law of any state in the country, and it's a much tougher law in California than the federal law. Federal law makes all kinds of decisions about, are you a political committee? Aren't you a political committee? If you're a political committee, you're regulated. If you're a social welfare organization, you're not regulated. Lots of social welfare organizations are now doing all kinds of political work. They're just a cover for political money. California said, we don't care. We don't care what you call yourself. If you spend $50,000 in a political campaign in California, you must disclose all your funders. And they're now moving, the legislature in California is now moving to require that the names of the three largest individual donors be put on every TV political ad in the state.
Should
what
be.
This points out is that states can take action and move ahead of the federal government, which is stuck, which is gridlocked. The Federal Election Commission is gridlocked, 3-3, three Republicans, three Democrats, never gets anything done, never enforces the law. And California said, we're moving ahead, and other states are starting to do it. There is movement, and there's room for reform on dark money, on amending the Constitution, on public funding, on gerrymandering. It's happening all over the country. We've been talking all about the downside, Richard, but there is a very interesting and surprising and encouraging upside to reform in this country that I hope we have time to talk
about. Yeah, how about CTAC and minimum wage and the raising of that? How can that help?
Well, the minimum wage is interesting because the federal minimum wage was being raised pretty regularly up until Ronald Reagan got into office, and he didn't raise it at all during his time. And then after Reagan left, the minimum wage was raised a bit, but it hasn't kept up. The minimum wage today in America, federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, is 33% below where it was in 1968, adjusted for inflation. So it's a really low floor. There are now 28 states that have said, this is baloney. In fact, Governor Cuomo in New York is pushing for a $15 minimum wage statewide. There are 28 states that have raised the minimum wage higher than the federal minimum wage. So states are moving ahead. And that's happening in red states as well as blue states. It's happening in the middle of the country. Was the story of SeaTac, the little town that surrounds the Seattle-Tacoma airport. And the people there were trying to get a higher wage. For the folks who push the wheelchairs, load the baggage, clean the cabins, do the kind of the grubby work around the airport, and they couldn't get it done through normal union negotiations with the companies, so they decided to have a referendum in the town of SeaTac, and believe it or not, against all the money that the airlines and the businesses put into the referendum, the popular vote won, and it was amazing. It won by something like 77 votes. SeaTac became the first city in America to have a $15 minimum wage. Mm. And now Seattle is moving towards a $15 minimum wage. San Francisco, you've got Chicago, all around the country, $12 million in Kansas City, $12 an hour in Kansas City. San Jose is up to 10. You know, a lot is happening around the country. And
Hedrick,
again,
yeah.
An indication that people pushing at the grassroots can make a difference.
Mention
I'm trying
we,
to capture this
yeah.
and reclaim the American dream,
yeah.
Richard, my website.
Right. We have only a couple of minutes. Quickly, what about public financing of elections in Connecticut? Give us about 30 seconds on your thoughts on that, because we want to come to a closure soon.
Well, the point here is, what do you do to counteract the influence of mega donors that can come in with all kinds of money, and how do you encourage people to give small amounts of money, and how do you get politicians to cater to the small voter and the small donor? And one way of doing that is either with maxing tax credits or matching money, which is what New York City and Los Angeles do, or public financing campaigns, which is what's done in Maine and Connecticut and Minnesota and Arizona, four very different states, and some other states as well. Again, here, John, Richard, the point is, people can take the initiative. It isn't just this story here, this story there. It's what can we do? This is a political year. People can do things. Gerrymander reform is going on in 21 states in the country, trying to break up these political monopolies that the parties have created for themselves to protect incumbents. They deprive independents and moderates of the vote. The turnout is typically small. You can find out all about this on ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org.
Right.
This is this website I've set up because the news media are not covering these stories.
No.
They're one-shot stories. People don't know where to go to get this information. And when people get the information and discover that in Illinois and in Maryland and in Virginia and in Florida, there are moves against gerrymandering, my God, we could do something in our state. But they think they're all alone. They think it's hopeless.
Yeah.
So one of my ideas here, and I appreciate you giving me a chance to talk to you about this and to your audience, and Florida is a model. I mean, Florida in 2010 passed this amendment to the Florida Constitution to outlaw a gerrymandering that would favor one party over the other. And the Republican legislature and the Republican governor ignored it, and people took them to court, and now the courts are enforcing what the people of Florida voted for. Florida should fly its flag high.
Yeah,
Florida's leading the country on this.
I only have a minute, Hedrick, a quick answer, a quick question in the closing moments. Two questions. Can we, first, can you perceive of Donald Trump getting the nomination? I'm going to put you on the line for 10 seconds. Is it possible?
I don't think it matters a great deal.
I think
the system's got to be fixed, Richard. The focus on individuals, which is what people do and what the media does, is keeping people's eye off the ball. The ball is the political system is broken. It doesn't matter who gets elected. They're going to be dealt with. It does matter who gets elected.
Let me ask you a question.
It doesn't matter a lot, Richard, because they're going to be facing a broken system. We have to fix the system.
No question. Do you think there'll be a third-party challenge either from his wing or the mainstream if he gets it nominated?
Yeah, I think there's a great chance the Republican convention will be brokered, that there will not be a clear Republican nominee coming out of the primaries, and they'll have to work it out. And that will work to the against Trump and in favor of the establishment Republicans.
Mm.
I think that's a highly likely. And Trump could decide if he gets, in his opinion, gypped out of it, he could decide to run as a third party.
Right.
Trump is very hard to predict.
Yeah, that's for sure. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. I want to thank you, Hedrick Smith, for joining me on The Advocates and speaking to these critical issues, the great American divide in America, how we should address this ongoing debate regarding the government's social and economic responsible. Have a happy new year to you and yours, and thanks for coming on.
Great to be with you, Richard, as always. Very interesting discussion. I hope people got a lot out of it.
I hope so, too. Be well. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived The Advocates broadcasts, you can access some of my website, www.theadvocatesradio.com, with the information my guests we posted. Next week, I'll be hosting Professor James Longo of Washington Jefferson University, and we'll be discussing Have American Students Forgotten History and Why? Thank you very much. Happy New Year.